Hey everybody, welcome aboard the Dollarbin Express. I am Adam, and I will be guiding you on your journey today. In an attempt to finally bring you one of the most informative panels from HeroesCon 2010, Defective Comics, a celebration of superhero oddness. Also, this weekend, Saturday, April 23rd, we are going to be down in Athens, Georgia for Fluke. It's going to be a really good time. It's a great way to share and hang out with other self-publishers and mini-comics creators. It's $2 to get in, $8 if you want a table. Tables are first come, first serve. Doors open at 11, so get there early to make sure you can get a spot. It's at the 40 Watt. For more information, go ahead and check out www.flukeathens.com. That's FLUKEATHENS.com. So on to the panel.
Hi, everybody. William Klein is a noted photographer who became famous in the 50s and 60s with a shallow focus, detached visual style that he applied to both commercial assignments, one of his professional jobs for Vogue, and to his so-called serious photographs, photos taken only for personal and artistic self-expression. His most prestigious works are book-length photo documentaries of major cities, New York in 1955, Moscow in 1956, Rome in 1961, and Tokyo in 1962, that avoid cliches and patiently scrutinize neighborhoods and shops, faces and funerals, like an anthropologist examining the surface of another world. Though Klein was born in New York in 1928, he settled in Paris in 1948 after a stint in the U.S. Army, and he's lived there as an expatriate ever since. Along with photography, he worked as a painter and a sculptor, and during the 60s and 70s also directed several films. His first, Who Are You, Polly Magoo, from 1966, is a satire of the fashion industry based on his job at Vogue. But his second goes in a very different and very radical direction. Influenced by late 60s Parisian radicalism, French New Wave aesthetics, and his own opposition to the Vietnam War, Klein directed and wrote Mr. Freedom in 1969. A film critic Jonathan Rosenbaum described as, quote, conceivably the most anti-American movie ever made. Mr. Freedom, if Captain America or flabbergastingly totalitarian United States, is sent to France to battle Mushitna, famed French actor for Eugene O'Reilly in a brown fat suit. Red Chinaman, a blow-up dragon about 30 feet long that attacks Mr. Freedom in a subway station, and any other commie trying to infiltrate Western European democracies. The movie begins with Mr. Freedom on patrol in his city, much like Detroit, circa 1967, as he responds to race riots with a shoot first and ask questions later.
This is Klein, that's one of his photographs, and here is the beginning of Mr. Freedom.
Thank you. the last time you loot a magic mix, Marco. I'm gonna set you right, boy. I ain't a looting. I'm a shooting.
Hey,
now, everybody, let's all sing together. F-R-E-E-D, D-O-M spells. F-R-E-E-D, D-O-M spells. Freedom! We fight for freedom.
Your presence is required at Central Freedom. Your presence is required at Central Freedom. Over and out.
I gotta go, folks. But before I do, here's another souvenir from Freedom.
First, Ben will share a panel discussion with Colleen Cooper, Evan Dorkin, Jeff Parker, and Chris Kent. They're all ferociously talented people working in both alternative and superhero comic books. What is it like to strike with the body? We'll hear about that. Then I'll be back with a scene from a superhero-themed movie, maybe even more strange and obscure than Mr. Freedom. After which, Chris Schweitzer will blow our minds by talking about the diverse way artists like Jeffrey Brown and Matt Kent managed to smuggle idiosyncrasies in the superhero franchise comics. And Ben will examine the chubby, unspeakably malicious Superman in Chris Ware's Happy Novelty Library. And then I'll conclude with a clip from the most peculiar Batman knockoff movie ever. Before I turn these over to Ben and the panelists, however, I'd like to dedicate this panel to, and I should show a picture of her. Sorry, not very good at this. To Marie Severin. She's a veteran of the comics industry who colored Harvey Kurtzman and Bernard Krigstein's art at DC for holy cow's sake. Who taught those of us reading Marvel comics in the 1960s how to laugh at those superheroes and ourselves. So if I can invite the panelists to come up and join us now, that would be great.
Yeah. Yeah, we're good. Yeah, come on, folks. I'm going to leave the lights down like this, and that's all right, because we have slides and stuff. Here's the thing. Wait. Come on up. I'm afraid you'll have to get intimate and share a microphone.
All right.
I'm just going to holler as long as people can hear
me. Just chicken.
Yeah.
All right, so welcome to our guests. Thank you guys so much for agreeing to be on this panel. I know our panels are more of a pain than most people.
Okay.
Taking these in alphabetical order. Colleen Cooper, you can use your processes of deduction.
Hey, y'all.
Four includes the two Small Favors collections for Eros Comics and Banana Sunday for Oni Press. She's also, though, part of the reason she's here, has done a substantial amount of work for Marvel Comics, books like Lockjaw and the Pet Avengers, X-Men First Class, and most recently Girl Comics. So welcome her. Evan's only here because he thinks that I'm going to buy him a beer at the end of this.
I thought you would give me $10.
Forget about it. Just beer.
I have the email.
Just beer.
All right.
He's done books for SLG, otherwise known as Slave Labor Graphics, Milk Cheese, Dork, and his most recent book, I believe his most recent book, is Beast of Burden with Gil Thompson, which is a Dark Horse book.
Yeah.
And his reason for inclusion here is his series of offbeat superhero stories that he wrote and I believe edited. Did you pick these artists out?
No, if I edited this, I'd have better clothes. I would have made some money. I picked some of the. It's you don't want to hear it.
I'll ask you about it.
Okay.
He did this as World's Funnest, and then there was two Bizarro books, in 2001 and 2005. So welcome, Evan.
Hi.
This is Jeff Parker, hailing from right here in North Kakalaki, I believe.
Actually, I live in Portland.
Everyone lives
in Yeah. It's federal law. You can come on.
I'm trying. I can't get out of the house.
He's been drawing comics since the mid-90s. Most recently, though, much like Colleen, and sometimes with Colleen, he's worked on some of Marvel's less typical, more offbeat titles, things like Marvel Adventures, Avengers, The Age of Sentry, and Agents of Atlas. And, you know, anyone who knows anything about comics will be familiar with the All MODOK issue that was penned by Jeff. So, welcome.
Thank you.
Chris Pitzer here on the end is founder of Richmond, Virginia's Ad House Books, which publishes works from by artists from super well-known people like Paul Pope and James Jean to total nobodies you've never heard of, like Dustin Harbin. He, along with co-editors Dean Hatfield and Scott Moore, produced Project Superior, which you may have seen. It's an anthology of kind of alternative cartoonists' take on their sort of original superheroes that they've come up with. So, welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
Briefly, what is each of your, if you could just go in some sort of sequence and tell me what your kind of background is with superhero comics. And is something, did you grow up reading them? Did you start reading them then stop and then get back into it as prose? Did you never read them until you got a paying gig? Have you never read them now? What's your sort of personal affiliation with kind of mainstream superhero comics?
Jeff can start.
You guys, they have a Bojangles in the convention center.
I know.
Want
some? Oh, I do, but all right, I'm not feeling very good.
Colleen? No, I've had chips, thanks.
You're all just denying yourselves. And
I had it yesterday.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, and then I did
just
not,
get
I,
to it.
They've got an Einstein bagel too. And it's just never had this before.
But I'm okay. still denying it since I had it yesterday. That's the problem.
As a kid, I just like a lot of people, just read comics off the spinner rack. My dad owned a grocery store, so my tubby little self just sat there reading comics all the time when I wasn't stacking bottles, and went off, did whatever, got out of comics for 10 minutes, and then was right back into it in college. At some point, I moved on to independent comics and just like every kind of comic. But then, you know, to make a living, I somehow found myself with people with capes on their backs again. And that's fine. I like them all, like I say. But, you know, if the paradigm were Western comics, I'd be writing the Avengers all riding around like the Magnificent Seven on horses, which would be pretty awesome. And but, you know, it's superheroes. So I try to infuse some kind of indie qualities or just from other genres into that because, whatever, I'm still going to force my taste on people. So it's cool. I've been lucky enough to work with Colleen, other artists that are mentioned, like Dean Haspiel, stuff like that. You know, it doesn't all have to be whatever sweaty continuity porn fanboy type thing you think of with mainstream comics. It can be anything, because like when Marvel first made their big splash in the Silver Age, they really were, it didn't look as polished as what DC was doing. It had a kind of indie crude vibe to it that everybody really responded to. There was energy, people were into something, and it felt slightly not safe, you know? So I think that's something to shoot for. I don't know if that was what Ben's question was at all.
I'm going in order. Shall I go?
You can go whenever you feel inspired.
That would be 2012, probably.
It's going to be a good time, though.
Depending on the medication that I'm being given at the time. I also bought comics off, I didn't really buy that many comics off the spinner rack because I didn't have any money, but I had a child of a divorced father who would rather buy us comics. My sister and I at the Te Amo on King's Highway in Brooklyn than speak to us or actually get to know us. So every week we got a very hefty pile of Marvel comics in the 70s. Marvel was reprinting their 60s comics at the time, so I got to read a lot of the Ditko and Kirby books that Stan Lee wrote all over. And
I like the way you spelled out the process there for everybody very succinctly.
About the divorce? You want to hear more about that? Or about, what are you talking about?
Hold on. No, Stanley wrote Oliver.
Well, you know. Forget. Let's not get into it. That's a different panel.
It's called Marvel style.
It's a difference. Yeah, it's called screw the artist style. You write all the incidental stuff and plot it and create all the characters and draw it, and I'll be a millionaire in the future, a billionaire in the future, and your kid will laugh. Anyway. And you can try suing us. We'll see how that works for you. Anyway, wonderful world of comics. Yeah, smile and stand. I'd be smiling too if I screwed over everybody that heavy. Anyway, it's good to have a Martin Goodman in the family, or as Bob Kane knows, a lawyer. The rest of them, hey, they just created all that crap. What do they get? Anyway, I didn't know this as a kid, and I just really enjoyed the comics by Jolly and Jack and Stanley and Swinging or Strange or Sad Steve Ditko or whatever they called him back there. And my sister got all the Harveys and the Archies, so I would read them when we were done. So, I mean, I was into other genres back when they had them. And read a lot of comic books and had an unhealthy obsession with them, like most people who are in this industry, whatever comics they're into, and copied the comics and wanted to make them for a living. I still want to make them for a living. I'm hoping that happens someday. In the meantime, I guess, I read a lot of comics, dropped comics because I wanted to be an animator. I went to film school. I wanted to be an animator, and I also wanted to get laid, so I dropped comics. This didn't really work out. I went to film school. I did not get laid in film school. I decided I hated film students, and it's not a joke, and I spent about, I don't know, $60,000 of my family's money on learning that I really wanted to sit in the back of the room and draw comics again. So I got back into comics and hoped by the age of 30 that I would pencil a fill-in Spider-Man issue. That was pretty much my goal at about 18, 19, 20 years of age. I worked in a comic store called Jim Hanley's Universe back in the day. I'm sorry if I rang any of you up. I apologize for everything I said about your purchases. I'm better now. And the black and white Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles boom happened, and any schmuck who could hold a pencil got a job in comics. I was a schmuck and I had a pencil. So I got a job in comics, and reading things like Love and Rockets at the time allowed me to learn, you know, Jack and Stan, knocking Stan. I mean, I am a fan, but, you know, come on. But Jack and Stan showed me that anything that you can draw can be put into a comic, and guys like Kurtzman and Bill Elder showed me that anger, that humor could be a weapon. And the Hernandez brothers showed me that your life could be your comics. So all that stuff kind of got combined, and instead of wanting to be like a third stringer, mid-carter wrestler for Marvel in DC, I started doing my own comics because anybody could. That's the beautiful thing about comics. The sad thing is that I stuck, and I could still do comics, but I got better, and my sensibilities or what have you, and my feeling of my desire to do humor comics kind of fused with the superhero stuff that I did, and eventually I got some work at Marvel and DC and the companies that won't hire me anymore, and I did characters like Fight Man, which was a critique of comics at the time that, I don't know, nobody bought, nobody listened to, nobody cared. And World's Funnest was a critique of DC comics that I got them to pay me for, but nobody got the joke, because if you make fun of a decade-spanning continuity, clenched, ass, uptight fan book, but you make a continuity, uptight book, and you can only understand it if you've read 40 years of DC comics, it kind of defeats the point. I've been unemployed since 2000, and I would hope that everyone would please give me some money at my table.
Huh. Follow that.
All right. Well, I guess we're all about the same age, around 40 or so. Also in the 70s when I was small.
It's double my job.
Yeah. My grandmother worked in a five and dime, so my older sister and I would get piles of coverless stripped comics, and I've been reading them since I was born. My older sister would read the horror comics. I would read the Harvey, the Archies, all the superheroes that we happened to get. I grew up with an encyclopedic knowledge of all the superheroes' origins without even knowing it, so it's just like in my head. When I was 12, I got a subscription to X-Men. When I was 13, I got a subscription to ElfQuest. When I was 14, I found Love and Rockets. And just kept going. Eventually, when I was in my 20s, I met my now husband, Paul Tobin. And he was making some... he was making some comics for SLG and sort of got me into it and made me understand that you don't need to live in New York City to make comics. You can just do them wherever. I hadn't known that before because I thought they had to let you. We did a little independent stuff called Attitude Lad, which I hope nobody ever sees that. And then a little while later, I was working at the comic shop with him and noticed that all the ladies who came into the store ended up getting the porn, like skipping all the...
Erotica.
Yeah. and I was thinking about it, and the other thing that they would get was like Johnny the Homicidal Maniac or Lenore. And I realized that all these, you know, and I kept hearing about how women never read comics or whatever, and I realized that they were... getting the not superhero comics. They were getting the stuff that they don't think of as comics. They were getting the stuff that they just wanted to read. So I started doing some porno comics.
Erotica.
because I wanted to do something that was actually kind of good. And so I did. And after that, we did some stuff that wasn't porn, but it was also fun to read. And
Like Banana Sunday?
Like Banana Sunday, for example. Or for specific.
I'm just saying.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks for the help. And then I met Parker. And
is someone transcribing it so sigh shows up in the middle?
That was a dreamy sigh, though.
It was.
No, it wasn't. Oh. We're like this brother and sister act where we're just all like, rrr.
It's all rrr towards me.
Sort of brother and sister act in a porno comic.
No.
It was pretty wrong, but every time I read it, I thought, this is wrong.
That was... And he convinced his editors that it might be cool to have these like funny X-Men strips in the back of one of his specials, and they were like, I don't know, that doesn't sound cool. And then I did it anyway, and they were like, oh, okay. And then they just kept letting me do it. So yay.
No, that's the way all editors are. Sorry, Chris. I don't mean to generalize, but sorry, Chris. All editors. Really, no one believes anything you say. No, this will work until you actually show them it'll work. And I don't know, I stamp around like a baby or whatever. And then I did like two little strips with Colleen. And then, this is awesome. And then suddenly nothing about my input was awesome about it. It was all Colleen. And then they have been hammering her with assignments ever since. And it's like, told you were going to like her. And then, but that's the way it is. And, you know, until someone takes some kind of risk. And it doesn't seem like much of a risk, but... You know, they fight over what goes on every page or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But so, and now, would you like to share with the class, Mr. Dorkin? Can we go back to slave labor graphics?
No.
Would you like to?
Let's let Chris talk because he has really.
You know, I had a prediction of how this would go.
Is this pretty much
like
about
me
it?
Going, yeah. You and me going, yay, and having
a meh.
I'm just not saying
it. And Chris going,
meh. I'm actually suppressing some really negative shit right now, so this is hard for me. Anybody who's seen me on a panel knows I talk a lot more than this. I'm trying to be really human about this.
Cool.
I think it's Chris's turn.
Just really quick, I guess.
Say what you want. Say what you feel, man.
No, I mean, basically, I'm a fanboy at heart. Yeah. And Spinner Rack when I was younger, dropped out, came back. I met Evan on the streets of San Diego one year.
Really?
With Fred Schiller. That was a big moment, because I did work...
Was I busking or something? What was it?
You're sitting next to Maxie Crum with that string coming out of his mouth?
No. He was a talent. I couldn't get the quarters the way he could. I was eating heads off chickens, but he got all the money. I would sit outside the Jack in the Box that used to be there. And,
those were the days.
Nice to meet you, Chris.
Yeah.
As I recall, Fred gave me a dime. You gave me nothing.
Fred Schiller.
Oh, Fred Schiller.
I feel very old.
So, yeah, I worked at Eclipse for a year.
Mm.
And then...
Were you the guy not paying everybody?
Yeah, I got...
I'm sensing a thing.
Some of those bills, but...
It's called comics, buddy.
It's comics.
You know that. Your company pays once in a while.
Yeah, once in a while.
As long as your name's not Kirby.
Moved back east. Started up Ad House Books after attending SPX for a few years. Small Press Expo around D.C.
And you still wanted to publish after going to a few of those?
It's a hobby.
God bless you.
Yeah.
I slipped my wrist after the first SPX. I was in a,
I missed the first one.
Mood, too.
Yeah.
It was one room. It was happy. Everybody was throwing darts at Dave Sim. If you hit, it was great.
But yeah, that's
glad you like that, Ben. You must have met him.
All right.
All right,
I think introductions are done. I'm
holy crap. That was the introductions.
Thanks, everybody, for coming out.
I'm going to attempt to alternate real questions with stupid questions. So I'm going to start with a real question.
Just do real stupid questions.
Stupid.
Here's a stupid one. Ask us if we know what a royalty is. Pay poor tax, $15. That's what I always think of.
That's the way all comics work. We're talking about alternative comics. Like the different way things work.
You can say that with a straight face. You're a better man than I am.
So all of you have done some work to some degree with superhero comics. But I get the impression that like a lot of your work isn't really viewed by your kind of regular superhero comics reader as being kind of their thing. And I, as an occasional superhero comics reader, I don't exactly understand why, because when I pick up, like if I pick up one of Jeff's books, I mean, other than the fact that it has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
That's my new innovation that in the 21st century.
It doesn't seem to be that much different than comics that I remember reading, superhero comics as a kid. I mean, each of you have a different approach to superhero comics. What is it about this approach that makes the kind of like super fanboy people be a little bit like, I don't know about that. You know, that's a little weird. That's not my thing. Like,
they're really good at sensing when something's not of their...
Yeah, I mean,
You put a little tail in there like a gorilla or something, and they go, that's not for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't...
Or else he'll say, gosh, I really enjoyed this, but I don't know.
But I feel bad about it.
I don't really know why. Or yeah, this like, takes some getting used to.
Yeah, like we were talking about that with Tom Fowler, who did Mysterious the Unfathomable with me. Tom's a world-class talent. He works for Mad Magazine a lot.
I work for Mad. I'm not a world-class talent. That doesn't make you a world-class talent.
It wasn't a cause effect. It was a he is also a world-class talent.
Oh,
and
I see. I
should have
done it the other. Oh, man.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
But. Man, the fans get hostile or whatever because he'll draw like a big nose or a belly on a character.
It's too cartoony.
Yeah, they see cartoony and they just freak out.
Stupidest thing anybody could ever say.
Yeah,
other than it's just comic books.
I hate that word.
But yet Europeans will just go, oh, I must have it. Every time they see his stuff, it's like because they don't have whatever. They do. They go, oh.
Yeah.
And whatever was
starred. You're talking about the Spanish, right? Okay. All Wait, Europeans. I mean, what
they,
public school?
They pull
did
their mustaches out and whatever, and then they just
Baytruck.
And they kiss it. Types. They kiss the comic, or whatever. Because whatever reason, they don't have the stigma about whether being taken seriously or not. The same thing kind of happened in science fiction prose, where at some point it became this humorless void because everybody wanted to be fandom got in it and they wanted to be taken serious. So they wouldn't do anything until, you know, maybe like Neal Stephenson came along that where you could maybe go, eh.
Or Douglas Adams.
Yeah, and then he really
they don't like the fan that we're talking about. We're not talking about readers. We're talking about fans, and there's a difference. They don't like humor in superheroes unless they do. You can't argue with people who say, I am sick of spending, I am not going to pay $4 for a book that doesn't have enough content in it, and then they complain that you have too many words in your book.
Yeah.
You cannot win with these people. I mean, and you can't try. So what you can do is hope that you get enough paying work to just keep you going, because if you're not I mean, generally, the people at this table don't seem to work on the books that last or have the major characters or in continuity to any kind of incredible degree. They're books that, you know, sputter along. If you're lucky, you get your 12 issues. Maybe you get four. And nobody gives a crap. When I did a couple, I went from having Joe Quesada pat me on the back and say, I'm glad you're doing stuff for us at Marvel in 2002, I think, at Pittsburgh Con, to him admitting he never read anything I wrote for Marvel. So that's.
I wish you would just do that with me and get it over with.
It was a great. Well, it was a great way to find out that there was no point in me trying to do something. Well, I mean, there is a point to you trying to do something that you'd hope that the editors and the readers would like. But I was on a sinking ship, and I was doing a miniseries that Dean Haspiel was drawing, so it was too cartoony.
Not on Yancey Street.
And I was doing the Yancey Street book, and then I did a couple issues of Agent X, but everybody jumped ship because the Gail Simone fans dumped the book. But I thought the book was really, the two issues that I did were funny, I thought, and they were really well drawn, and it was, you just heard Chuck Jones cricket noises once this thing came out. So every 10 years I do something for Marvel that Marvel regrets, because there are jokes in it, and I tend to stay away from the stuff that people really like anyway. I don't want to deal with continuity myself, so I'm not upset by this. I expect this. Any job I get from these, you know, I wrote a eulogy for when Captain America died the 18th time in 93. Kevin Maguire drew it. I enjoyed it. I got to have a Kevin Maguire, and that's all I took from it in the paycheck. I did the best I could. I hoped 15 people would pay attention to it. But if you don't work on the books that have a lot of... Ascension, the death of, return of, Arsenal's mother-in-law, blah, blah, blah. Part two, blackout, watch out, there's no electricity. Buy the HeroClix, volume 7. You don't exist in this industry. Even if you do work for Mad or do work for TV shows that millions of people are watching, you do not exist. You know, I'm not actually angry about that. I know that going in. I avoid the job. No, because I avoid the jobs that will get me involved in office politics. I was offered work on the 2099 books for the X-Men book, and I knew that maybe this would get me health coverage back in the day, and I also realized it would get me involved with...
You would need health coverage.
I would go out of my... because I'd be a mental case having to... You know, I work... When I did a... God, real quick, and I'll get off... When I did this one thing, I had to ask, can I use this character? And I had... You know, you have to fill out billets and paperwork. Can I use Kingpin for one panel? Well, this office owns King... Oh, God, that's baby shit. I want to write a good story. I do not want to deal with office politics. I found out this guy's not, Hawkeye's dead, and this one's, and I could not figure out what was going on. And it would be like being dumped into wrestling, but there were 15 feds, and they all had the same people wrestling in each fed, but in different costumes, and they would die each, and I'm like, I just can't do this, and pay money for it. So anyway, yeah, now I am getting angry, sorry. It has nothing to do with it. As a reader, I can't understand what's going on anymore, and I'm a geek who... still draws these characters for fun in the house and stuff, and I just, you know, and, you know, Hawkeye's, I don't know. I don't know anymore.
Like, Hawkeye just keeps coming back up.
Hawkeye.
He's a loser. I
sympathize with Hawkeye. He couldn't get a date, and he kept quitting and getting fired, so I sympathize. It's true.
I know, it's true. He's poor.
He's poor.
He got,
he's
got $12 so in my pocket, but at least my wife hasn't been killed 15 times by strange men.
So you're doing something right.
No.
Okay.
I kind of like that I get to do pretty much, within restrictions, I get to do whatever I want with my little short stories. I'm kind of lucky that way. I'm way, way under the radar, and I like it there. I know Parker would kind of like to be above the radar because he's got kids and a mortgage. But and Thunderbolts, everybody, it's awesome.
Thanks.
I grew up, when I was like 8, my favorite comic was the Howard the Duck issue where he's just walking around Cleveland in an existential angst ridden what happens the day after you save the world and nobody knows. I miss that, but I'm glad that I don't have to deal with what happened after that with Howard, where, you know, they gave him pants and they had him show up in actual superhero books and have him show up every once in a while in an Avengers comic or whatever, and because that's not what he was about. He was about Steve Gerber being a crazy son of a bitch.
I would argue with you on that one.
Yeah?
Yeah. He shows up in Man-Thing. Spider-Man's in his first issue. He hung out with the Defenders.
Well, yeah, but it was goofy,
I think we're
right?
Gonna have to throw you through a table, or so we're gonna have to fight now.
But that Treasury edition, I love that. I had that Treasury edition.
And the Spanker.
But.
I just wanted to prove we know this crap.
I know. Yeah. Do you like the Man Frog? Do you like the Man Frog as much?
Drawn by Val Mayer.
Sure, like the cow, the vampire cow.
Yeah, we had Val Merrick in our studio the other
day.
We're
old and we don't get it anymore.
I know.
This is what's just, we're all middle-aged and it's sad.
I'm sorry.
And, but our tastes haven't changed since we were eight.
And Howard would have his arm ripped off and shoved up his rear. He'd be raped 18 times. He'd come back as Dark Howard.
That is DC.
Oh, yeah, Marvel's had nobody die in the last few
He would be fried
weeks.
And eaten, you know.
Yeah, he would be. Red Hulk would be chewing on him.
I'm sorry.
Blue Hulk would be chewing on him. Gray-green Hulk would be Amber Hulk. Got no idea for a character Hulk. Yeah. Give me my check, Hulk.
I feel like we're in danger here.
You guys
work at these companies. I don't. I can say whatever the hell I want. I'm doomed.
You want to contribute now?
Chris, come on, Chris, kick in here.
Be the voice of reason, Chris.
Yeah, be nice.
Are you having fun, Chris?
I wanted to listen to Evan talk. So.
Yeah.
Come over to my house.
A really good scene.
Bring some Bojangles. Come over to my house later.
Nice.
I start walking back to New York with my family in a Tuesday, so meet me in about 3 weeks.
Okay.
It's that bad. I'm walking to conventions these days. It sucks.
So somebody had mentioned.
What are you doing here?
Somebody mentioned the visual style. I think it was you talking about putting like a big nose on somebody or a belly.
Yeah.
Cartoony. That's
cartoony.
The word.
Too cartoony.
That's the dirty
Real
word.
Real quick, I know I don't talk too much, but let me kick in here. Kyle Baker once said that comics is the only medium where you are penalized for having a commercial art style. And it's true.
Yeah.
And I'll just leave that out there. Because, you know, you can work on cartoons for animation. You know, I mean, I'm not... my wife and I have written for Space Ghost, Batman Beyond. I mean, I like superheroes. I know I'm giving the impression I don't. But I'll show you my Kirby collection when you come over with the Bojangles, Chris. And... you know, we work for Yo Gabba Gabba right now, which is apparently a hit series. And we didn't create it, okay? Calm down, all right? It's a 6-year-old pair of pants. My car is 16 years old, okay? Please. But we suck, you know what I mean? In retail shops. You know, 10 to 30% of the retail shops out there know who we are and order our books. And that's been a constant. And you just can't, But that's what Kyle's talking about. You can walk in from doing stuff for Mad or Spin and Esquire magazine. I mean, I have a really nice resume, but not for comics, you know.
Well, that's what I was going to ask about. Actually,
about Kyle?
Baker written here. It's like, it seems like you got Kyle Baker or like when Jeff Smith does Shazam or something like that.
Well, that did well.
Did that do well?
Yes, it did do well. Jeff Smith's a law unto himself. Seriously. There was No, it's not a joke. There are certain people who are going... Jeff Smith is one of the only successful self-publishers left, if there ever were any, other than him and Sim and
Colleen.
Yeah. James Owen, maybe. We're reaching back for franchises back in the 90s and 80s. But I mean, Jeff is a law unto himself. There are certain people who are, you know what I mean. The rules do not apply to Jeff. He's worked very hard to get there, but they don't apply.
I mean, do you think that, like, as far as like, say, I'll take go back to Kyle Baker, like his Plastic Man series, which I thought was awesome.
Yeah.
Do you feel like there's like a sort of mandated visual style like that has to kind of be in place for something to be like super successful? And like if so, like who's doing the mandating? I mean, do you think it's an editorial mandate or do you think it's just?
I think it's a marketing mandate, frankly.
You think so?
Yeah, I think it's the guys who count the beans.
I don't think so. I think it's the editors. / fans. I think it's the professional fans who have inundated the industry since the 70s. I'm a professional fan.
Uh-huh.
I think we all are.
Uh-huh.
But I think ever since the days of Roy Thomas and Neil Adams, things have shifted to a certain specific way of telling stories. Where, you know, the art might not look like Neil Adams exactly. Hyper, quote, realistic.
Yeah.
A lot of lines. All these days that's, you know, sort of changing because the colorist is doing the work the inker used to do in a lot of books. But the Roy Thomas school of, hey, I'm a big fan and I'm now going to tell the stories that I always wanted to see. A bit of self-indulgent. I'm not saying this is bad, but I'm saying this is kind of what we're at across the boards. Editors and artists who want to do what they want to do on other people's characters, fans be damned most of the time. This is my personal opinion, of course. And like I wanted to do, you know, why did Peter Parker lose his glasses in 1963? Well, damn, I'm going to do a 6-issue miniseries explaining that because that bothers me. And in a large part, that's where we've got. We've got our new characters are Red Hulk. Our new characters are a girl in the costume rather than a guy. Our new or my son is in the same costume. There are no new characters.
they say they want new characters. You give them new characters, and they go,
"They don't want.
They don't want.
So I don't want this."
There hasn't been a new superhero that really caught on since Wolverine. That's what.
Except unless you want to count Hellboy, who I do count.
Oh, okay.
That's yeah, the that's
well,
you know, the,
okay.
A bright shine.
I'm talking in a pantheon of a continent.
Oh, in Marvel and DC,
yeah,
if you want to go for hits, yeah, they'll go. Well, Lobo. Yeah, my mom knows who Lobo is. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Lobo, the tough guy for the medium that can't have tough guys at the time.
But
and the weird thing of the style flip is that if it's something fantastic like super people flying around, it has to be drawn very realistic. But if it's something like war or you know just real life stuff, it's suddenly cartoony is what. Dominates. I don't know why it's exactly flipped like that.
It's the readership, I think. I think you can have Jacques Tardy do a serious war story with big nose caricature characters and oddball, you know, shapes and stuff. I mean, Chris Ware tells very serious stories with a very cartoony style. But if you were to put that into Siege or something like that, people would lose their minds. They would be very angry. I mean, I worked in a store for 6 years, and you worked in a store. They'd come up and go, I can't buy. First of all, these were people at the time, and I'm generalizing,
but that's
who
why
couldn't buy a black and white book. And they would tell you that. They go,
I
can't buy a black and white book. Well, you're buying Garfield, right? You read Garfield. It's black and white. Millions of people. Like, what happens if the color disappears? The story changes?
Well, that's why I say I think that the decision for who's doing the books are made by marketing, because they're the ones who are responding to the fans.
Oh, I was discussing. I thought he was asking about the art style and the writing style.
Oh no, I'm talking about who gets to draw a cover, not me.
Well, what happened with that? I'll shut up after I put this out there. What happened to the shift in the mainstream comics now, where I look through previews and nobody gets to do their own covers anymore? That's real. Nobody. Not only does no one get to do their own cover, seven people get to do the cover.
When I've
which is bullshit.
I've asked the VPs, they say they always want to get a maximum number of artists because they think they might get some tiny percent of people buying it just for another artist.
That's insane.
I know it's insane, but that's what they always say.
Because they are winnowing down. I mean, the sales figures are shrinking all the time, and I don't know what's doing with books now, but to watch them go after the same pool of dying people, we're all going to die in like the next 10 to 40 years. you know what I'm saying? And guys like, I mean, at this point, and you know, and this isn't even me making fun of them, but the people running the companies right now are, I don't know, praying that they invent something that keep only Marvel and DC fans alive for another 120 years? Because is Dan Didio sitting there going, well, when I die, I don't care what happens to comics. I've got my fun. Because the aging group, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of people who, I don't see a lot of kids here who wanted to talk about, well, they're all at a better panel right now of happy people. But do you know what I'm saying? I mean, my daughter is 5 and she's reading comics, and she'll probably read superhero comics. She is reading. She's reading Supergirls from the Silver Age and all that stuff. I'm not militant about it. I cannot show her what's going on in DC and Marvel these days.
No.
When just 10 years ago, when I did World's Funnest, Levitz would not let us use the Vertigo characters because he said we have to have a separation of church and state because we can't have kids going off and masturbating like monkeys after they read some Vertigo characters with Superman books. I mean, they would not let me use, Karen Berger said it was fine, they would not let me use Sandman and Swamp Thing just sitting outside a bar talking because the joke was Vertigo characters just sit around talking. They don't do anything. I could not use them. How many years later is it that these characters, Superboy and all that, are tearing each other apart? It's just a bizarre paradigm shift in comics that I don't understand. As somebody who likes gore and sex as an entertainment field, I don't like to see it with 75-year-old characters. I'm off subject, and I was going to let you guys talk, and I'm sorry. I'm going to shut up for the next 5 minutes, 10 minutes.
Okay, I'm wrangling things back a different direction. Now it's time for a ridiculous question, and I'm also going to get Pitzer in on it. So this goes directly to you.
I don't think you should be allowed to talk.
Here we
go. Okay.
You should be our Black Bolt.
Lamest superhero ever.
Oh, geez. Well, I mean, the first one that popped to my mind was, what, Forbish Man? Is that his name?
He's supposed to be like...
Well, that's what I'm saying!
I gotta fight him!
I guess I'm not. You shouldn't have asked me that question. Real lame? Oh, geez.
Not really lame.
Well, I'm really curious to read this new...
Like, they think it's good.
Well, I want to read this Arsenal comic.
Oh my God!
Oh, there's been so much talk about it.
He beats junkies with a dead cat.
Yes, I know. Jim Rugg brought me copies, so.
That is the Ed Wood comic of all.
I really want to read that.
Let's have some background on this. What is this? Yeah.
This is a comic where Speedy. I don't know where to start with this thing. No, it's this little green arrow. His daughter got killed and
has sex with this murderer that he used to be married to.
Yeah, they get fighting. He's missing an arm, and then he's impotent.
And he's shooting heroin into the stump or something with arrows that he bounces. See, don't you think he'd be mainlining with arrows?
His arrow
between your toes. I mean, if you're really gonna do this shit,
arrow,
do it.
We'll take care of this.
I mean, just get total James Ellroy on.
No,
this
just came out last week.
Yeah.
It's also part of the Johnny DC line. That's what's awesome.
It's a Justice League book. And then he goes out and he beats up some junkies looking for heroin with a dead cat. And then Batman shows up and kicks him and says, "I'm your friend."
It's like Davy and Goliath by James Ellroy. It's
and by the way, what we just did, that's what people on the internet call a review.
Yeah. But they give it 4.5 stars and say, "I'm buying the whole series." Yeah. I'm really mad at DC, but I'm buying them anyway.
Yes, you could get it today.
Yep.
It's like a car wreck.
I'm there, man.
It's called Rise of Arsenal.
It's actually pretty incredible. I mean, all jokes aside, I'm amazed this thing came out. Robert Crumb said this was the best comic he's ever read. Arsenal. Look, I want that comic with the cat. Okay, give me the cat comic. It's unholy. And these are characters used to hang out and fight like the Mad Mod and go-go dancing. And like, how could we fix these characters? Tarzan definitely needs the main line, and Dick Tracy needs to be blowing guys' heads off, drinking the blood. I mean, all successful franchises eventually add blood and dismemberment to that. You know, the Muppets, Mickey Mouse, Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids. Yeah, Toy Story. Come over here, baby. I got something for you. You know, it's no desperation whatsoever in this industry right now in the Big Two. I'm not working for Diddy or Quesada, am I? I don't know. Oh, that big mouth creep. He's just pissed off because I canceled his Metalman series.
You better pray that car holds up, buddy.
My car holds up.
Yeah.
New engine.
Work from DC.
Strut. Oh, wow. Yeah. You know what I realized, though? I never lived off that stuff. So I was okay. You know, my wife's 6 months pregnant, Dan Didio takes over, cancels my series, says it was too goofy. I wish I was making that up.
Oh, man.
Well, what are you going to do? Oh, I know, feel sorry for me. I know. It's true, though. It really sucked. But that's the freelancing panel. That's not the worst superhero. So now, you voting for this cat guy?
I haven't read it yet, but yeah, that would be my vote.
Vote for the cat guy.
Vote for the cat guy. I can't wait for the hero clicks in this one. See, that's what's funny. Hey, wait a minute. He doesn't like any of this stuff, but why does he know about it all? Screwed up on comics.
All right, any further submissions for lamest superhero? Captain
Marvel who said Split and all his legs.
He's good. He's good.
Which one?
Split, Captain Marvel.
The Split Captain Marvel who would say Split and his arms and legs would pop off. And
what?
Which Captain Marvel?
Marvel?
Late 60s.
Oh, okay.
I don't remember the company, but he only came out like twice.
Oh, right.
And he says Split and all his appendages come off. Now another guy says Split and the character's appendages come off. But yeah, that's what he did. I don't like the flying saucer Marvel guy that C.C. Beck did, the Captain
the
ice cream thing, but
yeah,
I don't like...
Do you like Herbie the Fat Fury, of course?
Yeah, I do like Herbie. Herbie the Fat Fury is excellent. He's a stud.
If you never got the Herbie collection, it's really good.
Yeah, Herbie's all right. He has magic lollipops.
He's a fat little nothing.
I know.
That's just... No way, it's Fat Fury.
Sorry. Who's the lamest? I mean, there's...
I think the latest comic... No, I don't like this whole Archie marrying Veronica thing at all.
Whoa!
I'm just gonna
That's worse than the cat.
It is.
Have you read those? Because it's disgusting.
I have.
Betty gets the shaft no matter what happens.
I know.
Somebody up there hates Betty.
When did Archie start coming out in volumes?
Archie
of
is about the dollars.
Five issues.
That's his thing.
Well, Archie sucks anyway.
Yeah,
anybody who wants to lip lock with him deserves anything that waffle-headed goof gives them. Because. Can anybody here, honestly? Can anybody? I'll give you a dollar. Name one good attribute of Archie Andrews. You wouldn't be like Archie Andrews.
He keeps a jalopy running.
He's no, because I know the girls fix the car for him because he's a scumbag.
Yeah.
I would be with Reggie in a second if I had.
And
I'd rather
why,
be with Dilton
and that's why
Doyle.
He
he's
married
be,
Betty in the first place.
Dilton,
she
Dilton's
can fix
only
his
one
car.
Who succeed.
Dilton's gonna be like Steve Jobs. There's no Jobs in that town. He's
Although,
gonna be running the.
Yeah.
I'd rather hump Mr. Weatherby if you gave me a truck. Him and Archie. Hey, Archie. Hey, I get away with everything. He's the biggest jerk in comics. I hate him.
Arr.
Hastings.
Yes.
I hate any character that uses a gun. As a kid, I hated any character that used a gun.
Oh,
because,
yeah.
Because it was like, everybody, I can shoot planets, and I'm Dark Phoenix, and I'm the Punisher. I can wing everybody in the pinky. Because he wasn't allowed to use, he was the biggest blue balls character on Earth. He was like, he comes out and goes, I've got a lot of guns. And in the set, you know, when he first appeared, he couldn't shoot anyone. So any character that showed up with a gun was an imbecile. And then, of course, in the night, you know, any character who didn't have a gun was an imbecile, because that's when they gave the Hulk a gun. Because when you have the powers of a god, you really need a firearm. Look out, it's God, and he's got a gun! And the guy can jump across the whole effing planet! And he's like, hold on a second, I'm
the Abomination.
I've got you covered. You're in it. Stupid. And that was a great run, too. My Hulk hits with the left hand. That's my new take on the franchise. Mine wears clothes and uses a gun.
And on that note, we're running out of time.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll sit back.
Everybody.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
For you guys.
Yeah, Chris, shut up.
I'm cleaning this up, man.
Thank you all for participating.
All right, thank you all.
I promised I wouldn't jib a jab.
No, our work here is done.
Never done.
Is this your that? Colleen, are you looking for
something? Yes, I am. I've done this before. I know about it.
Made by an animator named Lewis Clark, recorded in 1966, and went to City of Buffalo in the late 1970s.
Whoa. City of Buffalo was the
center of experimental filmmaking. And while he was in Buffalo, Clark saw the work of Bruce Conner, Joseph Cornell, and other found footage filmmakers who chop off old educational films, news broadcast outtakes, and obscure Hollywood movies in order to edit the footage into something new. The idea that it was possible to make new movies out of old ones deeply impressed Clark, although he took a slightly different approach. He decided to make movies using old ads, photo albums, home movies, and, more importantly, comic books. In the 2 Minutes to Zero trilogy made in 2003 and 2004, Clark animates drawings from issues of the 77 Sunset Strip comic book that tell the same crime story three times, in a 23-minute version, in a 9-minute version, and in a frenetic 1-minute version. And his recent Cumulo Nimbus is a wistful meditation on romance built around imagery taken from Silver Age issues of the Flying Machine. Clark says that the idea for the movie Pony Glass came from looking at Jimmy Olsen number 95, September 1966, an issue featuring the story, quote, Miss Jimmy Olsen, where the intrepid cover reporter dresses up like a girl to secretly investigate a crime syndicate and inadvertently became the girlfriend of the head gangster. Jimmy and Greg was by this time a common sight in Jimmy Olsen's comics. You see Leslie Lowe, girl reporter in issue 67, March 1963, Jimmy Olsen's female fan in issue 84, April 1965. Also known as Fred Hembeck's send-up of the whole phenomenon, quote, Superman's favorite transvestite, Jimmy Olsen, and Bosch Hembeck, number 4 from 1980, and Grant Morrison and Frank Whiteley's resurrection of this meme in the first pages of All-Star Superman, number 4. Reading Miss Jimmy Olsen, Clark wondered, what if this was serious? And it wasn't just that he put on women's clothes to go undercover to attract dancers. What if he really was gay? And that's what Pony Glass is about. With an eclectic soundtrack that includes Frank Sinatra and Paul Robeson, Pony Glass explores Jimmy's failed relationship with Lucy Lane, his unrequited crush on Superman, his torrid affair with Perry White, and his final joy with an anonymous purple masked man drawn by Gil Kane. Here's an excerpt from a late dark fight from Kurt Schaffenberger and others. So, I just
love one another forever.
We said we'd never say. Goodbye. But that was long ago. Now you've forgotten, I know. No use to wonder why. Let love die, but we'll go on living.
I'll be the first bit. I'll snap because they go pretty quick. I don't know. As long as that doesn't seem demeaning, I don't want it to be.
All
right. Okay. My name is Chris Schweitzer, and it's a pleasure to see all of you today. I'll sit if you guys don't mind. Have some back things going on. I want to talk about the writer slash artist or cartoonist, as a lot of times he or she is referred to, in relation to Marvel and DC superhero comics. The cartoonist is not really as much of a rarity in Marvel and DC comics as it might appear. Team books represent a hugely disproportionate share of the output of either of these companies. But within the framework of continuity, we've seen a fair share of solos. You've got Jim Starlin's Captain Marvel, and Thanos books, Walt Simonson's Thor, Howard Chaykin's Black Hawk, John Byrne's Alpha Flight, Jerry Ordway's Superman, Rob Liefeld's X-Force, Eric Larson's Defenders, and McFarlane's Spider-Man. Amongst many others. Rumor has it that DC is currently planning on allowing some of their superstar artists to take writing duties of some of their own books as a means to help be the next escalation of weaponry in the exclusive wars that they're going back and forth with Marvel. And in all of these cases, the cartoonists mentioned have one thing in common. Their work is very mainstream friendly. It is undeniably idiosyncratic, and sometimes it ushers in a zeitgeist that changes what mainstream comics means, but it is still very palatable to the general mainstream superhero reader. So what happens with cartoonists whose work falls outside the purview of that mainstream aesthetic, and what is their relationship to Marvel and DC franchise characters? Generally speaking, when employed, their work on these franchises characters on these franchise characters falls outside of continuity proper. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with the term continuity, what I'm using is basically continuity is something that within the framework of superhero stories means that if something happens to Spider-Man in Spider-Man issue 110, then in Avengers issue 320, you know, 15 years later, or however many years later, there is an assumption that that same thing happened to Spider-Man in Spider-Man issue 111, and that's all tied together somehow. This amount of backstory turns off some readers. For others, it's the whole point of the thing. But in any case, Marvel and DC both, with rare occasion, release stories that are sold as being outside of continuity. They stand alone, things can happen, characters can die, and it's not something that has to tie in with everything else that's going on. These are the stories where you find cartoonists who don't have that mainstream aesthetic finding work, generally speaking. You've got Kyle Baker's Plastic Man, Jeff Smith's Shazam, Paul Pope's Batman Year 100, and Darwin Cook's Batman Ego, Selena's Big Score, and New Frontier are all relatively recent examples, and all actually from DC, who tends to do this with more regularity than Marvel, up until very, very recently. Some, like Cook's New Frontier, despite being done in a style that the DC editorial and Marvel editorial will consistently say the fans will hate it, and we don't want to go anywhere near that, becomes incredibly popular with the superhero fans. But these larger projects, these are all sort of longer form works, and these are really a rarity. And the place where we are most likely to see these non-mainstream cartoonists at play is either as part of a creative team, either handling just the writing duties or just the art duties, or in short non-continuity stories, either in anthologies or as backups in kids' books. I think that Colleen's a good example of that. Well, Colleen and Jeff both are good examples of this, who are up here, in that both are cartoonists known for writing and drawing their own work, same as Evan Dorkin, but usually when they are working in Marvel or DC Comics characters, Colleen is drawing, Jeff is writing, Evan is writing. And so that sort of splits up those duties a little bit. Some, like Batman Black and White, have been played straight. But most are what would probably be called humor stories. But the question that I want to ask are they actually humor, or is simply their context, because of the unfamiliarity of the style or this format, does it make it seem funny in a way that it's not actually intended to be so? Recently, Marvel released a hardcover edition of its indie/humor miniseries, Strange Tales, which features short stories and gags of Marvel characters by a number of alternative and independent cartoonists, as well as Peter Bagg's 2002 megalomaniacal Spider-Man story. When I first decided to talk about this topic, I thought I would be using this book as an example to talking about the difference between artists who chose to try and produce their version of, say, a great like Ant-Man story, and the artists who fell into what I think of as the trap of parody, simply mocking the characters without bringing a real story into play. Sort of akin to the difference between like Scary Movie, which makes fun of Scream but doesn't really provide any story, and Hot Fuzz, which makes fun of buddy cop movies but is in itself an excellent buddy cop movie. And upon thorough examination of this book and really going through and critiquing it to talk about this, I found that my approach was really totally off. The artist that I accused of parody, which I do mean as an insult, because I've just never been a real fan of it. I feel like it needs to bring something else to the table, like I mentioned, are not really engaging in parody. On close examination of the work, one can see that the Tony Millionaire story, it's an Iron Man story in which Iron Man fights anthropomorphic cold cuts and a giant-headed rocket-traveling Eisenhower. It's not really making fun of Iron Man at all. It's simply a standard Tony Millionaire story with absurdist imagery and nostalgic elements and over-the-top abstracted violence. Similarly, Peter Bagg's Spider-Man is not really a hatchet job on the Spider-Man character, although in a recent paper article, something for Comics Comics, Bagg did talk about he did express his intense dislike of the character and of Ditko's art and storytelling in regards to the character. But even so, it's still a typical Peter Bagg story, in which everyone is cynical, ugly, and emotionally explosive. And what makes Strange Tales so unique from similar projects, DC's Bizarro Anthology, which, has anybody here seen that one? Okay, a few of you guys. And that one's interesting. I talked to one of the guys who was behind that, Chris Duffy. I talked to him yesterday, so it actually didn't include itself into the slideshow. But I was one of the things that I was curious about is why, in an anthology very similar to the Marvel Strange Tales anthology, you have all of these different artists who are known pretty much exclusively for being writer artists. You have Brian Ralph, who's never collaborated. You know, you have... you might have, I don't know. Jessica Abel, you have Dylan Horrocks, you have all these people who are known as writer artists, but every single story in there was split up. Someone was writing it, someone was drawing it. And he said that DC insisted that that was the case for legal reasons. It's easier to say, well, this is work for hire property. DC is able to say, you know, if they ever brought any of those elements into play, whoever it is that does a particular story can't stand up and say, well, that was all me and you guys owe me money for, you know, including this in, you know, the Justice League movie or something. So a lot of times that may be part of why this becomes problematic in regards to how a tier artist can handle this. But what makes Strange so unique from things like Bizarro Anthology and some other similar projects is that the line between the artist's personal work and their take on Marvel characters is almost indistinguishable. And it is, I think, through this book that we can best examine the potential and limitations of letting idiosyncratic auteurs handle such projects outside of a humor context. I'd invite the reader of this book, and I suggest, I'm sure there are people downstairs selling it, so take a look at it. But I ask you to divorce yourself from the context of the anthology and ask yourself whether or not these comics could work as a series proper. I've chosen two that I think showcase the limitations of combining distinctive cartooning and storytelling style with franchise expectations. And I've chosen two that show how wonderful these franchises, which are always just on the verge of becoming stale and soulless, depending on who's handling them and what direction the company chooses to take them, how incredibly wonderful these stories could be. The first is a Spider-Man story by the Norwegian cartoonist Jason. I should preface by saying that Jason is one of my favorite cartoonists. His stories are populated by this returning cast of animal characters. His dialogue is sharp and clever, and his action is understated. There's this realism to his work, the way that the stories play out, but there's also this intentional artifice. By using these animal characters, he never lets you forget that you are ingesting a fictional narrative. You're not, you know, ever losing yourself in the story. This particular story, in which Peter Parker rues the fact that he's never gotten into a bar fight, is a perfect example of Jason's work. And it feels strikingly similar to some scenes in his book, The Left Bank Gang, in which some of the characters also sort of struggle comically with what it means to be manly. And it's one of my favorite stories in the Strange Tales book, but I'm curious as to how it works as a Spider-Man story. Even if we ignore the art, which, as much as I love it, really doesn't have, would not be able to reach to the Marvel Universe proper, a big part of that being the fact that they're all animals. The story pacing, the characterization, the outcome, none of it would really work. It reduces the act of battle first and foremost, which is paramount to superhero readers, into something really simple and easily dismissible diversion. And it creates more sympathy for the villain, Dr. Octopus, who's in the last panel, complaining to a psychiatrist that he thought Spider-Man was being nice and inviting him for a beer, and then So now he's all upset. It creates more sympathy for the villain than it does Spider-Man, and sympathy is his biggest selling point. Like Spider-Man, we all like Spider-Man because our lives are slightly better than his. And it's basically, in short, Jason's work is ill-suited for superheroes. Conversely, next let's look at Corey Lewis's Long Shot. Now, I've never really gotten into Lewis's work. Has anybody here read any of his stuff? Shark Knife, Multiple Warheads, any of that stuff? Okay, it's a little bit too madcap or referential for my taste, but it works perfectly for this character. Long Shot, with his David Bowie mullet and his glowing eye, he's gone from being like laughably out of date to being sort of this ultimate proto-hipster. And his ability to teleport throughout the Mojoverse via channel surfing is tailor-made for Lewis's manic pacing. That the inhabitants of the Mojoverse are perpetually engaged in this ratings war means that whoever is writing the story could play this up by making sure that their slang is, you know, really up-to-date, what's funny is really up-to-date, and have this sort of precognitive sense for what is good these days, and Lewis definitely has that. And yeah, he definitely meets those standards, and the use of Longshot's luck power could easily explain away many of the zany and outlandish plot elements that Lewis is likely to involve in any of these stories, and in fact would encourage them and make them work a little bit stronger. The garish colors, the mix of domestic manga and video game influences, it's difficult to imagine a better fit for Longshot. And a title like this could have all the action, flash, and dynamism needed to satisfy a traditional superhero reader, but it could also tap into that manga girl / hipster / Scott Pilgrim market that Marvel really hasn't come anywhere close to grabbing in. And so this could be a really, I feel like this is an example of something that could be used as sort of an almost like a pilot for this type of story. Stan Sakai's Hulk story is also really quite clever in that it combines his stock in trade, which is samurai in Japanese folklore, with the Hulk character by making him a cursed oni, which is sort of a Japanese ogre, instead of the contemporary consequence of a gamma accident, and is subsequently able to shoehorn him into the samurai battle story. Now, Sakai handles the strength depiction amazingly well. These first three panels, you see Hulk sort of a little speck in the distance and then jumping in. It really harkens back to some of those better 60s Hulk comics. The landing, the smashing people around, the sort of shoving the horse. Sakai handles these actions in a way that understates, you know, Hulk's super, super, super power, where he's like, I'm going to punch the planet out of its orbit. And by showing him actually struggling against these things that none of us could do, it gives him the sense of being stronger visually than, you know, the fact that he can, like, pick up, you know, the Sears Tower or something. Like, it's hard to reconcile that with an actual genuine sense of strength, whereas, you know, him pushing back a horse and all these people, we can actually wrap our minds around that a lot more clearly. So his action handling is, I think, really, really nice here. And the thing that becomes the problem with Sakai's work here is that by confining himself to this period samurai genre, he's taken himself out of the running, or he's taken the story out of the running as anything but an alternative world version of the Hulk. There's no way that something that he would do like this would ever be the definitive version of the Hulk, the way that some people argue that Darwin Cook's New Frontier is the definitive Justice League story. It just simply wouldn't happen. And even samurai stories that Marvel could do, or that Sakai could do, so like Wolverine's Ninja Training or Elektra or Silver Samurai, they still require a contemporary take that Sakai seems reluctant to approach. And I think that by refusing to leave his regular sandbox, it becomes impossible to judge his suitability for handling Marvel titles. Matt Kent's Black Widow serves as sort of an almost short year one type of story for the Black Widow character. It's 3 days in Black Widow's past, in which she takes significant defeats and injuries with a lot of grace, trying to track down a particular assassin. Now, Kent gives Black Widow a lot of personality in a short amount of pages, narrated in hindsight with coy wisdom rather than sort of the Miller standard of present tense narration of what's happening. And what Kent does, and does extremely well here, is that he presents the Black Widow within the framework of the larger Marvel Universe. And even Kent acknowledges that within the context of this larger picture, Black Widow is a relatively unimportant figure. Hers are small jobs, requiring patience and nuance. She's dangerous and meticulous, but she's not flashy. Iron Man is flashy. Daredevil is flashy in that bottom corner. Hulk is flashy. Spider-Man, Whiplash, Captain America. All of these characters appear in the story and all affect what happens to and with Black Widow. But she is really just a shadow underneath these superhero battles taking place. And that's the way that it should be. A Marvel character that is a spy should be handled as such. And Kent has shown time and time again with his book Super Spy and Two Sisters and things like that, that he can handle, he can do spies with as much realism as John le Carré and as much panache as Ian Fleming. And too often, someone having a specialty, like a crime writer who decides he wants to do crime comics, you know, he might do a Punisher story or a Daredevil story, but it's really a crime story that happens to have Daredevil or Punisher in it. There's no sense of what else is going on. It's very unlikely that you're going to see Spider-Man pop up in that comic. And what Kent does here is he does both. He can satisfy the superhero purists, and he can tell a riveting spy story that all really interrelate. And it shows, I think that something like this can show that Black Widow, who has never really been a super popular character and not ever really had as established a personality as some of these other characters, could really be a powerhouse book in the hands of somebody like Kent. And there are any number of other examples throughout the book that could be judged with the same criteria. Jim Rugg and Brian Maruca, an artist and a writer, yes, but they're a package deal more than anything else, to the point that we sort of associate them as one thing, or at least I do. But their take on Brother Voodoo that could handle, they show with their take on Brother Voodoo that they could handle any number of Marvel's sort of 70s exploitative lines. Recently some friends and I were talking about how the only way the Ghost Rider movie could have really worked is if it was done like a 70s biker grindhouse movie. And I think that Rugg and Maruca could really handle a Ghost Rider title or something similar in that vein. Jacob Chabot's Looking Good, Mr. Grimm feels heavily influenced by the types of stories written for Marvel Adventures and the types of stuff that like Parker and Van Lente and Tobin write. It's got a fight scene, a hilariously bad semi-obscure villain, complex interplay between the protagonists, and the thing's attempt to grow a mustache using Chia Pet formula is perfect. And this story showcases how easily Chabot could shine. He does art for, I think, is it the X-Babies, Marvel Babies, something? Do you guys know? Yeah. If he was able to write some of these stories as well, how really great they could be and how much fun they could be. They're almost sort of like Fantastic Four in that same spirit of something like Little Lulu or Good Archie, which I know Evan says is an oxymoron. But some, however, like Chris Chua, Junko Mizuno, and Peter Bagg, James Kachalka, they showcase how ill-suited they are, either artistically or structurally, to handle the superheroes the way that would be acceptable to superhero readers. And I'd like to see more of these types of anthologies, perhaps even web-based, from the big two, because I'd like to see them be used with an editorial eye towards spotting what would work as a comic, because there are a lot of fun takes of alternative and indie comic people doing superhero stuff. And there's some great examples. There's the Cooper Skeeter thing, there's the Bizarro stuff, there's any Jeffrey Brown did like a Wolverine fighting zombies mini comic. But I think that what I would like to see is Marvel and DC injecting new blood into their stories in a way that, and into their franchises in a way that really sort of makes them fresh and new and not just rehashes of things that we've seen over and over again, where it's, you know, this character who is the relative of this character who died, who used to be this character, who did, and it just, it keeps adding on and broiling on. I think that by taking these properties and doing what a lot of times the films do, which is make a little standalone story, that can be something where you pop into a bookstore and, you know, or a comic shop, and they say, you know, well, I want to read a really good, I don't know, Ant-Man story. You know, with Batman, you send them to Year One, you send them to Dark Knight, you send them to The Long Halloween. You know, with Superman, you might send them to All-Star Superman. But what do you do with these myriad other characters that do not have sort of this nice standalone property that can get people enthused about the characters to the point that they might want to read the longer running things? And I think that this is where Marvel could really, and DC could really use these types of anthologies to find some takes on the characters that they might not have previously thought of. And that's it. Do we have time for short questions? Or? Okay. Okay.
Published in 2000, it's received many awards. It was one of the Guardian's first book award. It was an American Book Award recipient. It was one of Time's 10 best graphic novels. But you probably know it, if at all, as being kind of a poster child for what's become a cliche about indie comics, which is this sort of morose, you know, woe is me, dreary kind of story. And, you know, I reject that as an accurate characterization of indie comics as a whole, but might kind of be on the nose here. So, what's my next slide? Okay, that's fine. Because the basic story of this Jimmy Corrigan is that the adult Jimmy Corrigan is going to meet his father for the first time. And it goes exactly as poorly and awkwardly as you would imagine that does, given where his reputation. There's a couple of parallel stories about Jimmy's childhood and the life of his grandfather and his great-grandfather. But it does include some kind of odd elements, and one of them is the Superman, who you can see up here, in addition to a number of weird things, like, you know, Jimmy occasionally turns into a weird-looking Victorian robot and he dreams and various other things. There is this Superman guy who I really like. He's a comic book character in Jimmy's fictional world, apparently, kind of like Radioactive Man is supposedly a real fictional comic book character in the Simpsons world. Although it's never really explicitly stated in the book, you never see a Superman comic book. The first time he appears, I think I've got a slide for that, is when little Jimmy goes to a classic car show to meet this kind of washed up, you know, kind of Adam West-esque guy who apparently played the Superman on a television serial. So it turns out that when he goes up to meet this Superman character, his mom comes and starts berating him for being late, and the Superman character then picks up his mom and goes home with him. So you can see this love is kind of horrified last panel where, you know, like, she's offering to get him some coffee and Jimmy's in bed, sort of being haunted. Next panel. Later, the adult Jimmy is in his office, and he's looking out his window, and he sees what appears to be, you know, Superman about to, you know, leave a tall building in a single bound. Yet, alas, it was not to be. It was apparently some random person dressed as the Superman who fell to his doom. In the next panel, he appears in. Sometimes appears as kind of a dream figure. Again, you've never seen this actual comic. You've never seen an actual comic book of this guy, but he appears in Jimmy Corrigan's having this fantasy where he's not like a morose, awkward guy. He's supposedly talking to his son up here in the top panel, and this like little tiny miniature Superman appears like a bird on his windowsill, and then gets really big and picks up their house and carries them off in it and dumps them upside down and shatters the sun into like a million bars. So that's the end of that. Even with next one. At one point, you know, Jimmy is injured, and one of the EMTs here appears as Superman. That's really nicely done, I think, with the color there. There's a reason for Square is one best color for at least been nominated for many, many years. So he sees one of these EMTs. And finally, at the end of the book, I had to blow it up because it's so small, we see maybe the only sort of kind of vaguely sort of positive scene of the Superman, which is he's finally carrying Jimmy Corrigan to safety. You know, this might not even be a narrative element. It's almost more just like the end papers. So Vince asks, what's up with all this Superman stuff? Well, you know, obviously, first and foremost, you know, don't let any of us indie guys fool you. We all grew up reading comic books, at least if we're over, you know, superhero comics, unless we're over 30 years old, we did anyway. And by Ware's own admission, sort of creepily enough, this Superman character is kind of a father figure. There are references in the book to Superman, the Superman character, some pretty important points. You know, there's a climax of the story where Jimmy's father has been in a bad accident, is in the hospital, and Jimmy finally gets to meet the father's adopted daughter, and Jimmy's got this Superman shirt on.
I think I had this line.
Yeah, so Jimmy's got this Superman shirt on. I don't know how to suit for all this, by the way. And, you know, and of course, the Superman, the real DC Superman, is kind of a nice thematic fit for some of this Chris Ware stuff, or particularly for Jimmy Corrigan, since, you know, Superman was also abandoned by his father. At least deliberately sent away at any rate. And there's a strong kind of autobiographical element to some of this, because Chris Ware only met his father once, and it was while he was making his book. You know, I can imagine that, you know, the story of how Superman, you know, winds up apart from his dad is probably a more appealing narrative to have than, you know, your fatherless than whatever may have happened, like, you know, dad was love. But it's interesting that backstory of this, if you've ever seen this book, it's a square book about this big. And what it is made up of sections of this story that appeared in issues of a comic book called Acknowledge Library that he used to put out. I think on the cover? No. Okay. So anyway, he put these issues out and later bound them all up. He bound up all the Jimmy Corrigan elements and put it forth as this supposed graphic novel. Well, it's interesting that there's a few little bits and pieces where you can tell he's gone in and changed the panels here and there. There's one big thing that he expunged when he put it all back together again, this story that's in Acme Novelty Library number 10 that features the Superman pretty heavily. So basically what's happening is that Jimmy's mom is dating this jerk Nelson. And you see poor Jimmy back there in the back seat. Jimmy hates him. So Jimmy wishes Nelson were dead. And then Jimmy realizes that Nelson has stolen his mom's money, like taken out her bank account, but claimed that he's got grades at work, and they're going to go on a vacation on the whole road. And so what happens is that the ship sinks, and then, you know, they think that they're all doomed, and then of course Superman comes and picks up Jimmy and takes him off, but, you know, apparently leaves the mom and dad to drown. But Jimmy thinks this as well. He doesn't realize quite what's going on. So then what happens is Superman takes Jimmy to an island where he begins showing him the happy life that his mom and Nelson could have had if only he hadn't been such a horrible child. See how happy they could have been? Well, not anymore. And you wish for it to happen. So Superman then abandons him on this island. And it leaves him there. I love this. Well, Jimmy, at least maybe you've learned a valuable lesson. And so at this point, then he begins grabbing Jimmy's broken arm very cruelly and making him cry. So, and he returns periodically to taunt Jimmy. And at one point, he leaves. Let's see. Click. Yeah, at one point, he shows up and leaves him one of these little animation, kind of old tiny animation things. At least just one penny. So he spends a lot of time trying to figure out if he's truly bored enough yet to be able to want to use the thing. So it turns out, you find out how through the story, some Superman partner shows up on the island suddenly. You realize that it's a pornographic movie that's in there. Jimmy doesn't see it, but Superman's partner kind of checks it out and takes off. And so then finally, Superman appears and says that he's going to take Jimmy home. And Jimmy's so happy, he says, I want to go home, I want to see my mom again. And Superman says, your mom? Well, all right, Jimmy, but you know, you could have seen mom all along, right? And so he uses the penny. I mean, this big panel is just brilliant. Well, I'll serve this thing here one day.
Oh my god.
So I think it's pretty obvious why this wasn't in there, I guess, but I mean, remember reading this when it came out in 2000 and thinking, God, what a pessimistic world. But then I guess, you know, in light of recent events, it's like, well, you know, I guess people with a lot of power and the ability to do almost anything they want are, they tend to kind of just be selfish jerks. You know? You kind of think about the whole collapse of our economy. It's like, I mean, was it run by the Superman guy, you know? So anyway, it's clear that this Superman character that Chris wears, it's pretty cruel and sadistic, but you know, I think his inspiration for this character is closer to home than one might think. There is another fairly famous Superman and Jimmy relationship that you may be aware of. And Ware mentions in a Comics Journal interview that some of his favorite comics as a kid were the 60s DC comics, like the Superman titles and the Jimmy Olsen titles. So here's some of my favorites. Yeah, this is where Superman has adopted Jimmy Olsen, and he's displeased with his smoking jacket. I'd wear that smoking jacket every day. And so he's like, he has to set it on fire. I'm sorry, I have to destroy it to teach you a lesson. It's just like that Superman guy. What else do we have? I'll put a few of those. Yeah, so here's Jimmy. It's like, so Superman has this incredible power, and he can do anything to help his supposed pal. But instead, he uses his power to, like, put him in these, like, embarrassing, like, humiliating situations in which he's forced to, like, learn to do the right thing. Here he is, like, you know, where he has to spend all this money, otherwise he'll have to lose it all. He's like, sorry, money bags. What else do we have? Yeah, this is my personal favorite, where Superman, where he's being forced to marry a gorilla. Superman, they all start with sorry, Jimmy. Like, sorry, Jimmy, but as a local witch doctor, I now pronounce you man and wife. So I guess that's where, you know what I mean. So I guess that's where Jimmy's finally has failed to learn his lesson. So, it's, you know, I think that, well, Chris Ware has perhaps a well-deserved reputation for producing some dreary comics. I think that his Superman character has, you know, it's got one foot pretty firmly planted in Ware's sad sack nature, but, you know, I think it's got one foot pretty squarely planted in the tradition of, you know, the superhero, you know, superhero genre's best and yet most ridiculous traditions. You know, whatever you think of Chris Ware's work, you gotta give some slack to a man who's imagined father figures based on the character who, like, incinerate a Father's Day present with deep vision, or, like, force someone to marry a gorilla in order to learn a valuable lesson.
Until his death in 2009, Steckler survived on the fringes of the film industry by turning out Z-grade movies, selling video copies of his movies through the website, and working as an adjunct teacher of film production at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. In 1966, Steckler wrote, directed, and shot an accidental superhero movie called Rat King of Voodoo. The first half of the film is a competently made, gritty juvenile delinquent story, originally titled The Depraved, by a nice neighborhood girl named Seedy, played by Steckler's then-wife, Carolyn Brand, who is harassed and kidnapped by a band of tough thieves named the Chain Gang. As legend has it, about halfway through production, Steckler became bored with competence and suddenly asked two of his performers to don homemade superhero costumes and become Rat Fink and Boo Boo, stupid caricatures of Batman and Robin. Another legend, the title is Rat Fink of Boo Boo and not Rat Fink and Boo Boo because the film development lab made a mistake with the credits that they offered to fix for $50, but Steckler didn't bother to shell out the dough. The original janky aesthetic of The Depraved is replaced by an all-out farce as Rat Fink and Boo Boo rescue CD, clobber the Chain Gang, and, through a series of circumstances that defy logic and viewer comprehension, battle a crazy gorilla named Kogar and escape from a local quote-unquote jungle compound. So I can think of no better way to end this panel than by watching Rat Fink and Boo Boo and not Boo Boo emerge from a closet, a different closet than Jimmy Olsen, ready to battle crime, but with one failing.
So we'll end with this clip.
Oh, no. Okay. Your girlfriend back in one piece, you put 50 grand in the black case
and put it in the garbage can behind 1213 North Highland tonight.
That's impossible. I can't get you that much money by tonight. It'll take me at least until tomorrow morning.
No! Tonight. Man, it's gotta be tonight, baby.
Before dinner. Or she's had it. For good. You got it?
No way.
He hung up. We've got ourselves a little problem.
What are we going to do, Lonnie? They've got CB and you can't get the money by tonight. What are we going to do?
Titus, there's only one thing we can do. This is a job for you know and who. Awesome.
I was just going to do that.
You're standing on my foot, Titus.
And who's standing on mine? I'm doing my best to get ready.
The door seems to be stuck, Titus.
Oh, sorry.
Have you locked us in again? Help me, Titus.
Wait, I'm charging my battery.
Let's think and boo-boo. Friends to those who have no friends. Enemies of those who make them an enemy. Champions of women and children everywhere. Rat Fink, mysterious masked nemesis of hoodlums and racketeers the world over. And Boo Boo, by day, a mild-mannered gardener. By night, the scourge of the underworld. Rat Fink and Boo Boo, together they blaze a four-fisted campaign against the enemies of truth, justice, and the American way of life.
Remember, Boo Boo, we only have one weakness.
What's that, Rat Fink?
Bullets. Now let's go to fight crime.